go around and we've got some new faces and say who we are and maybe why we're here, and maybe we could share something fun or interesting, like something that you want to do this winter with the cold weather coming. That might be a fun thing to learn about if you want. I'm Lydia Sanders. I'm the chair of the council, and something I want to do fun this winter is I want to go tubing again. I'm not good for that. I want to go tubing. Yes, because that sounds like a lot of fun.
Maybe
snowboard.
What I want to do fun, I want to stay in the room.
I just want to stay warm.
And not fall down again. I don't want to.
Yeah. And just be safe this winter if there's snow or ice or whatever.
Adam Kravitz and this is the busy season for me, so I don't know. Fun for me is some of the events that I have coming up that we work on. So, and you know, cooking. I have a house now, so having housemates, I'm gonna cook a lot of turkeys this Thanksgiving. So, cooking.
We'll be right over.
I'm Emily Khalil with Clark County Food Bank. I'm a guest here. And one thing I'm really excited about is I recently moved and the place has a hot tub.
Yeah.
And I'm always cold, so I feel like it's a perfect fit.
Hot tub party.
Yeah.
Janet with Clark County.
No puns.
There's got to be something fun, Janet.
Michael Boris, Clark County, and my wife and I just bought a 1995 VW camper van. I'm rocking.
It's in the parking lot.
It's in the parking lot.
It's my daily driver.
It's awesome. In fact, we should hold a meeting here sometime.
Does it have peace signs?
No peace signs. But one thing I do also want to share, though, is I have a little dog called Porter, who is really cute, super energetic, really sweet, but he is as naughty as can be, and he's required a lot of adult interventions to keep him alive, because he just is not smart enough to not do stupid things. And like he's eaten a whole bottle of Advil, and I've had to take him to the ER. This weekend, we were camping in the camper van at Mayfield Lake, and we were the only ones at the shore, so I unclipped his leash for a moment, thinking that he'd sent a splash in the water, and he ran into the water and kind of started swimming, and then started chasing the splashes he was doing until he was like 15 yards out, and we were trying to call him back, and he's not a great swimmer, so he'd kind of start, when he'd start trying to swim back to us, he'd end up going in a circle, and he started panicking, and like, we really thought we were going to lose him, so I ended up having to strip into boxers and get in the water and swim out to him and bring him back. It was horrible. I mean, it was, and even Leo was just like, I don't want to lose you, you know, stupid dog, I mean, we love him. But we brought him back, and we were both, like, completely, like, you know, frozen for the rest of the day and shivering. But it was later I found out it was 42-degree water. Thank you for it.
Wow, that's a great story.
What kind of dog?
He is, we have two dogs and they're both rescues, so I don't know exactly. They're not a pure breed. But we're pretty sure he's part Doberman Pinscher and part Beagle.
Interesting.
So, yeah.
You should have stopped by my house and gotten in my hot tub to get all warmed up. Because I just got a new hot tub. And so that's what we will be doing for our fun time over the winter, is staying nice and warm in the new hot tub. I'm Rebecca Rice with Clark County Community Services.
I'm Renata Bolson, most of those people, and I'll do the presentation for them.
What about anything fun for winter?
I think I'm going to try ice skating. I haven't done it in 30 years.
Very good. Be careful.
One of the new community representative board members, so thank you for having me. We bought snowshoes at the end of winter last winter, so we got to use them once. So my kids are just at the age where they actually can do it themselves, so I'm looking forward to doing that.
Yay! And for everyone who joined us, we're going around and introducing ourselves and we're sharing one fun thing that we are looking forward to doing for winter.
So I'm Bridget and I'm probably going to stay inside right there.
Join you.
I can't think of the thing to do. But I don't like hot weather.
Well, you're in the right place then.
So I'm Peggy Sheehan, and I work for the City of Vancouver, and I've been going to Mexico for a while,
oh.
So that'll be something
to
take.
And Karen?
Karen Cameron. I don't know what else.
Something fun for winter
that
you're looking forward to maybe doing.
It's here.
It's still nice though.
I'm still in summer, late summer.
Right. All right. Well, good. Thank you. And thank you and welcome to all of our new board members. I'm really excited that we have a more robust board and we'll have even more soon. So super excited about that. So we need to approve our meeting minutes from our last board meeting in September. So we need a motion to do that.
Mm-hmm.
Anyone want a second? Okay. Any further discussion about those minutes? All in favor? Aye.
Aye.
And any opposed? Then we approve the September minutes. Thank you. So we will need to do nominations for the 2019 Executive CAB Board team. So right now, I'm the chair of the CAB. Bridget is the co-chair, and Mavis is the secretary. And we'll have that at our January meeting. But is there anyone interested, or does anyone have any questions related to that?
So we're not actually doing nominations? No.
So we're doing nominations.
Oh, we are.
We're taking names. If you are interested in any of the three board executive board positions, this is Lydia's last year being the chair, and Mavis's last year being the secretary. Now they can take on other roles on the executive team, but they can't stay in the same roles that they are now. This is their finishing their third year, and so we are opening it up for anyone that might be interested in being on the executive team. And so we'll take nominations here. You can email them to me in the meantime, between now and the next meeting. If you have questions about roles and responsibilities of the executive team, I'm happy to help with that. And then we'll take nominations again one last time at the January meeting, right before we actually vote.
And otherwise, I nominate Bridget as chair. You accept the nomination?
Oh.
Such enthusiasm.
You want to do a speech?
I nominate Lydia's vice chairman because that district is very critical. I'm being able to do my job if I can select.
Okay, that works. But I just want to make sure that we give opportunities for anybody else to. So anyway, so we will have nominations for that can come in, like Rebecca said, between now and January, and then we'll finalize that at our January meeting. Okay.
I'd like to nominate Adam as secretary.
Oh, okay. Is that something you're interested in doing, Adam?
I would have to get more information on that.
Sure.
Secretary has so much to do. You sign the minutes.
It's a tough job.
Okay.
We're meeting after the meeting anyways for another topic, so if any questions I can ask about or even.
Then possibly at the exit.
Okay. Awesome. Well, this should be pretty simple and easy then. Okay. Very good. So we'll finalize that in January. And then Peggy, you wanted to talk with us about the City of Vancouver Housing Fund update.
So, as most of you know, in 2016, the citizens of Vancouver voted to tax themselves to support affordable housing. The city administers that fund, and we get about $6 million a year. So far, we're at the end of 2018, and we've collected about, I think, close to $9 million, not quite 12, because it comes in a little bit less than $6 million every year. And we have awarded most of that funding. We have two projects that are completed. One is Meriwether, so 30 units of affordable housing, and there's some of those units are dedicated to folks who are homeless. We also have completed a renovation for Community Services Northwest of 5 units, and one of them is up at the corner. You probably drive by. It's up in the corner, right across from the Fort Vancouver Park and on Mill Plain. See, you see a big sign there that says Affordable Housing Fund. We have several projects under construction. Habitat for Humanity has several units. So does the Vancouver Housing Authority and REACH. We also awarded about $1.5 million for rental assistance, and that went to the Vancouver Housing Authority and to a consortium of providers in town. There's 7 different providers that's managed by Council for the Homeless and SHARE. And we ran the numbers for those, and they have each served, the Housing Authority has served 22 households, and 50% of those households are below 20% AMI. And then the consortium has served 132 households, with 58% of those being below 20% AMI. We received 16 applications for the 2018 and 2019 fund. It was about $6.4 million. Received applications for $8.9 million. We're pretty excited because 2 of the applications are from private nonprofits. From private developers, for-profit developers. The rest are from nonprofit developers, most of them you've heard of. If you lived in the community, some of them are brand new, are just starting to try to get their feet off the ground.
Heidi, yes, can you explain what AMI stands for?
Yeah, area median income. So at 20% area median income is our current area median income for a family of 4 in Clark County is 81,600. So 20% of that for a family of 4 is pretty low. The fund has to serve folks that are 50% of the median or lower. We also have some funding that we have designated for the homeless shelters, and we awarded funding for the homeless shelters as well. We had $600,000, and we saved a lot on admin last year, so we were able to also use the admin and up that amount, gave money to 3 shelters. One of the shelters is actually going to expand their numbers of beds. They're going to increase their numbers by 3 rooms and 12 beds. We also have, and that then this next year, we'll be asking council to approve a portion of the 16 applications. And what the city does, so we have a group of folks that prioritize applications, but city council makes the final decision. So they'll be making that decision. And it looks like January will be going to them. And we'll be also asking them to move the $300,000 a year that's designated for shelter to the Grand Boulevard building. And what else? And we're going to do some analysis on the use of the rental assistance, because our biggest issue right now for rental assistance is folks that are elderly, that more calls, and people that are elderly, the current system is kind of, we have to figure out something different to reach out to folks who are elderly. They aren't really getting served through that system. We have lots of property owners that are calling us to ask if we can try and work with the folks that actually live there in some of the elderly units. So we got to kind of figure out that. So that'll be to come. So it's pretty exciting. A community that voted, we're really proud that we are ahead of the game.
We're actually awarding dollars that we haven't collected yet. So the city has funds, so we're actually able to do that. We can award the dollars, and then knowing that some of these projects don't move forward as quickly as some of the others.
So the couple of applications that you've seen with the for-profit companies, what kind of projects are they looking for?
They're both construction.
New
construction.
Yeah. So any idea on number of units?
I don't have that right now. But I can, we're putting it on the website today, so make sure you guys can get a copy of it.
That's so exciting, though.
It is pretty exciting. Yeah. Some of them, you know, there, some of the projects that you might have all heard about, Veterans Village, that they've been working with the city over the past few years. We were able to rezone their property so they could put, they want to put, I can't even remember the number, but a bunch of tiny homes, and it's off of St. James. And there's been a lot of back and forth on that one, and they've actually are ready to move forward if they can have the money, so the property's zoned correctly. They've got the partners they need. Another one was Community Roots, which is some of you might have heard of. They are looking for a piece of property to also build. They want to build a community, small homes in a central area. A bunch of, there's some rehab ones. A bunch of folks are doing rehab. The city also has a multifamily tax exemption program where if you're building a project in a certain area, you can get up to a 12-year tax exemption, property tax exemption. And most of the, well, all of the buildings that are residential in downtown have built under that, been built under that program. And we actually received our first application for a rehab project. Anybody drives down Columbia Mill Plain?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so you see, I don't know if you've seen that house. If you're heading north, there's a house on the left that's been under remodeling for probably 2 years.
Mm-hmm.
I would say at least 2 years. And they are actually going to take advantage of this and have some units set up. So we're feeling pretty good about the mix of projects that we're getting. I think what's amazing is all of this has happened just since 2018. The multifamily tax exemption program has been out there for probably 15 years, but for most of the projects have just been requested council approval since 2015.
Has the city been supportive so far of like those communities and tiny house villages, things like that?
Oh yeah, we try to work with anybody. What happens though, it's a land-based issue.
Yep.
So you can build a smaller unit as even 150 square feet, but the land is too expensive, so nobody's going to do that.
Right.
So you have to have a benevolent property owner that wants
right.
to do that. But yeah, we passed ADU rules, so we're going to get on more ADUs. Next Monday, we're giving a presentation to City Council on all of the housing that we've done for the past 2 years. So it's going to be on the 19th. I'm happy to share with you folks the PowerPoint, but if you can either come to City Council and watch it, or you can watch it on CBTV. So. And then I saw the list is on the other business. Tomorrow is the, you guys have down here that tomorrow is the grand opening. I hope you'll be able to come. Had over 150 folks RSVP. We expect to have more than that. If you don't make it, the program is going to open at the end of the week. So I'm sure that, and it's open from 7 a.m. in the morning till 5 at night. So if you don't get a chance to come for this tour week, I'm sure you can pop by there and check it out.
So does that mean the current day center that's at Friends of the Carpenter will cease there on Friday or the day that everything's transferred over?
Yeah, I don't remember whether it's Friday or Saturday, but yes. So.
Can't wait to see it.
Yeah, it's impressive. If you had been there in the beginning, it's probably more impressive than. But it's still, it looks pretty good. So. Anything else?
Very cool.
I can share with you? Great.
Thank you, Peggy.
Uh-huh.
Miss Bridget, do you want to update us on advocacy task force?
yeah, we sort of, no,
available to everybody around advocacy. I don't know what the status of that is.
They're actually at Kelly's desk right now, except for that last document
okay.
you had sent, because I haven't had a chance to review and help answer those questions that you had on that.
Okay,
so
I redid the other page without the numbers, so
okay.
that was what you were waiting for, too. And the idea is that everybody would get a copy, and what I'd like to do is set aside some time, and maybe our next meeting or sometime, for people to go through. There is a list of organizations and networks and things in this town, and we really need to know who's connected to which one already. So that we get insights from them on what their issues are. And if we have things we want to lobby for, then we can get the word out to them, because it's part of our advocacy role.
How long do you think you would need to go over that? 15 minutes?
Yeah.
15 minutes? Okay.
Yeah,
because I'm starting to build the agenda for the January meeting, so
okay.
I could easily put that in.
Yeah.
I just needed to know.
So if we can get those sort of great.
I can grab those here in just a moment, and then we can have them. So
okay.
we can have them today, unless you'd like to wait until the January meeting.
Doesn't matter.
I think it's great to get people's hands today.
Okay.
Put a lot of
yeah, I have a problem emailing it. It's too big a file to email to people. I did try, but I think it got kicked by the friends. So, do you have an electronic version?
I
sent one to Kelly, but she said she got it, but I sent one to you too, and you got it, but you couldn't know.
I couldn't open it.
Right. So I've got to try again.
But you've got them, and you've got hard copies?
I don't have that last document. I have everything
yeah.
else.
Yeah.
And that's the one you're talking about, is this
yeah.
last version, because it's quite a large file.
Yeah, I could have. It's just Word.
Do you
oh, no, I PDF.
Do
yeah.
you happen to have it where you can put it on like a jump drive and
yeah,
come in and we can work on it sometime.
Sure.
So we can set up a meeting to do
yeah.
and kind of review that. And then make that way we have it and be able to get it out to everybody.
Yeah. The other thing I wanted to mention today is February 28th is Housing and Homelessness Advocacy Day. And sometimes this catches us by surprise. I know people plan ahead. So I'm hoping some people would join. This is the Council for the Homeless effort, and they're very organized about transportation or buses or whatever. So it would be a great idea for some of us to join that.
And and I have confirmed with Kate, they are arranging a bus.
Okay.
So
yeah,
you don't even have to drive.
I randomly thought they would. I should check. So
what was the date again?
February 28th. So there is an email address. Maybe I'll just hand this around.
It's also on the Council for Homeless website, and you can reserve a spot on the bus. I'm probably going to take the day off so I can go.
Anybody else plan on going?
I'm going.
No.
No.
Let's go. Let's do it. Let's make it a party.
I'm so scared.
Okay,
oh, sorry, that's not official.
And we will, Kelly, we're very sorry to lose Kelly. She put a lot of work into this. Best wishes for her future endeavors. In the meantime, we're going to occasionally meet as a task force without staff support, given how stretched they are. And we will meet and see if anything comes up that we need to adjust in here or any plans. Feed that back to staff so that we can do that.
One question for Michael. If we had a quorum go on that, would that be violating?
Oh, that's a good question. I don't think so, because
it's information only.
Well, and you're not meeting and making decisions. You're just, you know, you're signing up as individuals to go do advocacy. I'll check with our PA. That is a really good question, but I don't think that would constitute a meeting.
Not necessarily that we get a quorum, but just in case.
Yeah, no, that's a very good question.
Well, it could happen pretty easily.
Yeah. Now, you'd have to make it a point to not make an impromptu meeting. You know, you'd have to have that discipline.
We're not talking business.
You're not talking business. You're not,
right.
yeah. But I don't think, I'll check with FDA, but I'm pretty confident it would not be a meeting.
Okay.
Like if they had, if enough people from the cab went in the bus to advocacy day, and if it made a quorum.
We won't sit by each other.
But I'll verify with the PA. I'm pretty confident it would not be a meeting. But you would have to like make a point.
Absolutely.
You know, to
I'm familiar with the
yeah.
talking shop. We can do that.
So I took a look at this site. There are some things in here that would be worth going over in 15 minutes in January.
Okay.
So we'll do that. So I think this is just this information. It's in a different order. my brain was thinking so. So it's just the idea that wherever we go, we also have board member, and this sort of familiarizes us with our mission and vision and what we do, so that you can answer questions.
And this is the list you're talking about, right, Bridget? So this page right here.
Well, actually, I was there's also the Excel sheet, which is really hard to read in.
Oh.
There's a blue sheet.
Oh, I see that one.
All of that, if you have a magnifying glass.
Yeah, that's an instant value.
And actually, that one I might email. I don't know what's on the page. It would just be me to see if we are. Can I continue that?
So do we want to try to do that? Maybe since everybody has had these lists now, by our January meeting, we could at least talk through who's connected with who, that way we're not doubling up.
I'll email you the Excel, well, yes, it's Kelly's list. And,
thank you.
Okay. So for those of you that aren't aware, Kelly has left the county. Her last day was November 2nd. She's moved on. Today's actually her first day as an evaluation and research specialist for the Native American Rehabilitation Association over in Portland. It's closer to her house, and it's a little bit more in line with what her overall career goals are. So we wished her well. We had a lunch for her, very nice. And stuff. But yeah, we chatted this morning, and she starts her first day today. She's a little nervous. I wish Kelly all the greatest. And in the meantime, we're waiting for approval to open up the position to hire a new coordinator for the homeless crisis response system.
Yeah. With the transition of the county manager, they put a semi-freeze on all positions. So you have to go through a process to, you know, to open the position up. So HR and the committee have had Kelly's position since October 23rd.
Okay.
And we should find out, you know, hopefully this week we'll get the thumbs up to open up the position. So.
Okay. Michael, do you want to help us with a legislative update?
Yes. So I don't have a lot to brief you on. At the federal level, I know this morning, Rebecca let me know that the funding to states for CSBG has been released. There is not a change to what I reported to you a couple months ago on the CSBG funding. Is about $725 million. And Head Start I had a $250 million increase. LIHEAP had a $50 million increase. David Bradley has not given up on increasing the CSBG funding from $725 million to $750 million, but he's not given up on it, but he's not feeling very, very positive that it's going to happen. You know, obviously, you know, legislation right now is, you know, it's kind of at a standstill since we were just getting over the midterm elections. You know, we'll see what happens between now and January, and In the last couple conferences that I've been in with David Bradley, he is actually very pessimistic in terms of legislative movement post-January with the divided government, because his expectation is, number one, internal to the Democratic majority, there's going to be he's predicting a fairly ugly fight regarding who will be the next Speaker of the House and who will be what will be the next House leadership. And then he thinks that legislative agenda is going to really get bogged down with the partisanship, because the Freedom Caucus with the Republican side is going to be much stronger internally to the Republican Party, and they're not going to want to move things forward. The Democrats are going to have a lot of pressure from their constituents to focus on oversight, which is also going to increase acrimony both with the executive branch and tension with the Senate. So, David Bradley's take is, we're in for a bumpy ride, and, we'll see what comes of that.
And do you want to share with everyone who David Bradley is?
Yes, thank you. David Bradley is the executive director of NCAF, National Community Action Foundation, and basically he is our main policy advisor and lobbyist for all community action agencies, across the country. And he's been doing this for the past 35 years. He has a pretty huge reputation on both the Republican side and the Democrat side. He was a protege of, in the Carter administration, Sergeant
Shriver.
Shriver. And he was active in the passing of the last CSBG act. So that's pretty good. So that's on the federal side. What I've also passed out to you is the National Low-Income Housing Alliance Public Policy Priorities for 2018. There is not a 2019 yet. They are crafting it. You can see the things that they've been working on and that they're going to continue to work on through January. And more importantly, this is the brand new, fresh off the press, Washington Low-Income Housing Alliance state legislative priorities, which really focuses on increasing the investment in the Housing Trust Fund at the state level. There is an initiative to allow local communities to retain a portion of sales tax for affordable housing that they're going to be pushing on. There is what is unknown of that is what the impact to the state operating budget will be when a portion of sales tax gets, for any communities that hold back a portion of sales tax. And it sounds like the state is going to be operating at a deficit. This budget is going to have a deficit of over $1 billion. So this is probably going to be a pretty rough legislative environment at the state level. So that's a little bit of an unknown in terms of what the consequences will be if it's passed. In general, all organizations that I'm following are supportive of that effort. The Washington State Association of Counties had a meeting with the Association of Washington Cities to discuss this about 3 weeks ago. Both associations are supportive of this effort. There is some discussion right now, and both associations don't want to be competitors, for this effort on the sales tax moving forward. As proposed, or as the draft is going to be proposed right now, the idea would be that counties yet to make the decision if they want to retain the sales tax. If they do not make that decision within the first year, the cities have the option to retain their portion for affordable housing. And one thing that's in negotiation between the State Association of Counties and the Association of Cities is the cities that are like, hey, there are plenty of counties that we know are not going to do that. Why do we have to wait a year? You know, why can't we just go in and if we want to retain a portion and move affordable housing, do it? The Association of Counties is generally supportive of that. The feedback that they've given the Association of Cities is, okay, we're supportive of that, but let's figure out a way so that there's alignment with efforts. You know, because what could happen, you know, kind of like document reporting fees, is, you know, a city that decided to collect that, they might actually, a lot of the housing development will probably be in the urban areas. You know, that's just the way it happens. And if the counties decide not to do it and the cities decide to do it and there is an alignment, the cities might actually have fewer resources because they're going to be collecting from only within their city limits, you know, to do that. So just the feedback they've gotten is what is the mechanism for regional planning, you know, of affordable housing? And
what
that's
that percentage is what they're asking for?
I do not. I you know, what percentage of sales tax? I'm not sure what that is. I don't think it's defined in here as well. They're looking at more eviction reforms and kind of catching up to the city of Vancouver, really, and increasing housing and essential needs portion of for the because ABD people who are age blind and disabled eligibility criteria are being moved to housing essential needs. There hasn't been a sufficient increase of housing essential need funding to accommodate people, you know, that growth of hen population. In fact, in our county right now, we're serving almost 300 households that are on hen. About, you know, there's a transition of about 10 households per month, you know, go off hen, come on hen. But there's the waiting list is growing by about 30 households every month, you know, just because.
Is HEN still at the $197 a month laughable rate?
ABD.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, that's ABD. HEN is enough to get housed and stay housed while you're on it. So ABD is the fixed,
right,
is the fixed cash amount.
But ABD is moving to HEN, right?
So if you are ABD eligible, no, you become HEN eligible, and you get the cash amount.
So the so that is not the $200 amount. It's enough to live on, or
so no. So there are a couple of discussions going on. One is increasing the ABD amount,
right,
to match TANF,
mm-hmm,
for I think it's like one child or two, you know, TANF at a certain level, it would increase the ABD amount to about $400.
Okay.
I do not know if that's going to happen.
Okay.
But they're still at a very low subsistence, you know, below subsistence level,
right,
of cash award. If you're on HEN, it's not a cash award. It goes directly to the landlord and,
okay,
the utilities, but it's enough, you know, it's not a fixed amount. It's basically,
okay,
enough to get you housed. The issue is with HEN, eligibility is contingent. You know, like you have to be eligible based on DSHS determination and BDS that you're eligible for HENs and for HEN, and there have to be funds available for you. So, you know, there is HEN funding. There's ongoing HEN funding, but not enough to bring in new people on 10. You know, it's kind of like it's like the like housing vouchers. You know, you have to wait for people to move off HEN so you can move on to HEN. And with the expansion of HEN to include ABD people, you have an influx of people going onto the waiting list without the resources to bring them on for housing.
So are they going to be able to stay on ABD until HEN opens up a little bit? Or
Yes, you're not going to go off of ABD.
Okay.
You know, but ABD is insufficient
right.
to maintain housing. So that's the legislative effort with the Low Income Housing Alliance, and I've also included the Association of County Human Services recently just released 2019 legislative priorities. They're actually very similar to the state Low Income Housing Alliance, but they're, you know, there you have it for your information.
Cool. Thank you, Michael.
Yeah.
Okay, Rebecca, do you want to talk to us about CSBG?
Yes, so at the last meeting, Carl Hoffman with the State Department of Commerce, who oversees us as a community action agency, was here to do our tri-annual on-site monitoring. And so we have the final report, and so I brought a couple of copies. I didn't bring one for everybody because you don't really need a whole copy, that you can take a look at. When you kind of scroll through it, there's some comments in at the end of each section. There's a lot of, it's a very set form where you go in and you say, you know, it says, does the agency do this? Yes, no, that type of thing. And then there's a comment section at the end of each of those sections. So, for example, the first section is about board governance and the extra comments in there say that the advisory board is currently not in tripartite compliance because we just moved from the 9 to 12 board member. When they reviewed us, we are not out of compliance with the Act, so it's not a finding. It's just a recommendation that we work towards becoming a full board, and so they're fully on understanding of what the situation that we are in as we're trying to update the board itself. So each one of these sections has a little area for them to put comments, but overall, and here's one copy I'll start handing around. I'll hand this other copy around in a second. At the very page 18, the second to the last page, it has the overall monitoring summary, and it just basically states about the advisory board not being in tripartite compliance right at this moment. But some of the strengths and exemplary actions that they noted was that the bylaws allow for child care, transportation, and parking costs to be reimbursed to low-income individuals on a case-by-case basis, which is best practice. The agency created a very detailed and excellent strategic plan, as well as community needs assessment. The ROMA, which is the results-oriented management and accountability, is the process that is very ingrained into community action agencies, and I'm a nationally certified ROMA trainer, so we use all of those concepts in our reporting. So they're just stating that we really do use those concepts in our reports. The agency has an extensive performance evaluation process that's for employees and for Vanessa, the director of the department. The agency presented well-organized and extremely detailed documentation to show evidence or supportive items requested for the monitoring visit, so we were prepared. Typically, it takes two monitors 3 days to do the full monitoring. We had one person, and he was done in a day and a half. So we really were able to get him everything he needed, take a review, and get out of here, which he definitely really appreciated. That was a bonus for us. And he's mentioned that board files are maintained electronically, so all of your information, your applications and appointment letters and all the documents that were required to have you sign, we have them all electronically for them, and so they made that comment as a best practice. So overall, it was a great monitoring from the state. They were very happy with us as an agency, and that is the full report. Lydia, as board chair, got a copy of it sent directly to her, and she participated in an interview with Carl about the board and things like that. So it was a good monitoring.
Yay! Awesome.
Got through it. Wait for another 3 years.
And congratulations.
Thank you.
A lot of work, so good. Thank you, Rebecca. And then do you want to go into the crisis response system, the org standards?
Yeah, so you have two different documents in your packets today. These are for the Homeless Crisis Response System and Community Action Program Request for Applications. So these are all of the applications that were submitted at the pre-application stage. So we just wanted to give you an idea of what we received in each of the categories and how much they're requesting. These amounts can and a lot of times do change once they go from kind of an idea of what their program is going to look like into the full program, they may realize that they need more or less funding. And so don't pay too close attention to the amounts because that part will change. And then there's always the chance that they decide that they're not going to submit a full application. All of the pre-applications that are on this list have been approved. There were a couple we received that didn't fit into the program correctly, so they were denied. One was they've applied for rent well under community action when it should be in the homeless crisis response system. We opened up the RFA for them to move their application over so that they could still apply, that type of thing. You will see, Peggy had mentioned earlier the Community Roots Collaborative. They are applying to us under the Homeless Crisis Response System for Permanent Supportive Housing Assistance. So you'll see that application if they decide to complete the full application. You'll see more about that program that they're applying for.
It's going to be competitive.
It's very competitive, and there's a lot of applications. So one question I had, the last time we did the request for applications, all board members reviewed all applications and did scoring for all of the applications. Do we want to move forward with that, or would we like to break it down into maybe reviewing teams where we kind of split it up to where instead of having review all of them, I don't even know off the top of my head how many applications are here, but there's a lot. We could break it down to where maybe we have half the board reviewing half of the applications. And
that's what we did last time, we break it down.
I thought we did all of them last time.
It was, all of the board members reviewed all of them. Mm-hmm. And that's a lot of work.
It's a lot of work.
How long are the applications?
Because they're through Zoom grants, they're not, like, horribly long, but there are 23 to 25 questions. For each application, and some of those are just checkbox, mm-hmm. pretty easy. There is a lot of describe mm-hmm. how you're doing some aspect of your program. And they usually have 2 to 5 paragraphs in each of those. So, they're not horribly long. But when you take a look at both of these, there are a lot of them. So no matter what, it's a lot of applications.
Mm-hmm. So I count 31.
Total between the two?
In two separate groups. I think it would be really neat if they, I mean, I like to look at them all, I mean, just because that's what they have. But I also want to make sure that I keep them separate so I don't get mixed up mm-hmm. which part of money it's coming from. So
they're two separate RFAs in the system.
Right.
So you're going to look at these applications. And we'll look at these applications. And the way that we have the schedule set up right now is the Homeless Crisis Response System applicants will come in at our March meeting. So it'll be a long meeting, and all of our applicants will be there to do the presentations all about the Homeless Crisis Response System. And then we'll have an extra meeting in April that'll be the Community Action Program. So that way we'll keep it totally separate and try to help with that confusion crossing between the two different types of programs.
What date is maybe in March?
I don't know.
Any idea? Oh, shoot. Can you tell us about what the total amount is?
March 12th. I'm sorry.
Oh, shoot. You're not going to be. No.
Janet will be taking notes like she always does and about the programs and stuff. So, and we try to get those minutes out right away. We don't wait for the next meeting so that you guys have, for anybody that's missed that meeting, they can have a summary of what the presentations were. So we'll try to get that out as soon as possible.
Can you tell us how much money we're going to have for each of these categories?
So it's on it's on each of them. So if you look at the Community Action one, we actually broke it down into 5 categories. We did not receive an application for education, but in the right-hand corner it says the anticipated amount that we have there. So the education category, because we didn't have any applicants applications, we've moved that funding down into the support services. Those two categories have the lower amounts. Our total amount of funding was $390,000 for all of our community action programs. So we had $300,000 or $100,000 in each, the employment, health, and income and asset building based on what we funded in the past, kind of how we determine that.
So we now we're able to move the support services up to 90,000, so almost as much as the other categories there. And then you'll see that it's on the same thing. It's the same
I see
more math.
I wasn't sure what that anticipated.
Mm-hmm.
That's how much we anticipate. We are guessing on part of it because with the new house bill money, we're doing a forecast on only a couple of months worth of actual information and what we've received so far. So those amounts, this is very a conservative amount, so they're not going to go down. We wouldn't go down from this number, but we might be able to put additional funds in a category. But at this point, we're probably going to stay.
So if we want to know how much they were awarded last year, or on the last cycle, I should say, not last year, we could go to this sheet probably.
Exactly. It'll show what the contract
is. You could, but then there will be a lot of these that, you know, have not been previously awarded. Like, for example, Community Roots Collaborative, we've never received applications from them.
Right.
You know, so it may be not exactly apples and apples when you make that comparison.
I get that. But it's also interesting.
Yes, yes.
And we did, when we worked on, with finance, on how much we should fund total and how much we should put in each of those categories, we purposely looked at the last request for application and what we have been funding to keep levels, not change them too much.
Yeah, that was my question. How do you, when you got the anticipated balance, is that what's prescribed to us, or is that decisions that we've made on how much to put on each of these?
So that's based on finance, us working with finance on what we anticipate to have going forward.
And how do you decide to put 400,000 here or 350 there?
That's where we went and looked at the last RFA and what we're currently contracting out to the different types of programs.
So if we felt there was a need to change any of these, but we couldn't do that, is that correct?
No.
That's not our job.
Yeah.
Thank you.
So is this...
But let me just add on to that, though, you know, but... In terms of what the amounts are, not only have we looked at it in finance, but we've also sat down with both the Council for the Homeless and the chair of the COC Steering Committee and looked at currently what are we allocating to, you know, to each category, what is the funding that's available, do those amounts need to change significantly, you know, because like looking at the pie of how much is in rental assistance, how much is in shelter, how much is in outreach, you know, looking at the pie, do there need to be significant changes, and if so, what? So, for example, significant changes to where funding allocation is happening is funding's been increased to shelter. That's where, like, that $300,000 of intern housing, including shelter, that's for new shelter beds, and funding has been increased to outreach. You know, in a fairly significant amount. The other categories, it's really pretty much stable funding. I'm not talking about to specific projects, but to the types of interventions. So. There's actually been a lot of work and analysis, you know, behind those amounts.
And then as you go through the awards system, that can be, I know there are times we've made all the services amounts. We've had some money that they would shift from one place to another for some reason.
Yeah, it depends on how it comes out when you do the scoring, and so we score the highest scoring programs until we run out of funds. And so that, yes, there have been times where we've had 20,000 left over. Well, it's not enough to really fund a program, so why don't we move it to this where there wasn't a full amount? So we will have those discussions at the May meeting when we actually look at how the scoring laid out once you guys are
and that will be a discussion with you. Yeah.
So,
go ahead. So this is 2019 to 2021, the 400,000
per year.
Is
per year.
Yes.
So, and then these do not include the sole source funding, right?
Correct.
That is correct.
That's already happening above the or off the top. And then all of these have also gone through the vetting process, meaning that, just so everybody knows, because we have a lot of new board members, that the county has already done their due diligence in making sure that all of these agencies can meet the requirements.
Well, we haven't yet.
Yeah, so
oh, that doesn't happen.
So
no,
we changed the
that.
Process, and I apologize.
Okay.
So we did change the process with our other RFAs a couple of years ago. It was a lot of work to do the administrative review at the pre-application stage, so we
and not just for us, but for the other agencies.
Oh, yeah. No,
for
I mean for the agencies.
Yeah.
No.
We ask a couple of questions that might be key in determining their...
Very basic eligibility.
Yeah. Are you a do you have your nonprofit status? Have you been in business 5 years? Are there legal pending actions going on?
Sure.
And at that point, we would pull in and do a full administrative review if we needed to. I actually spoke with our finance person, because we do have a couple of new applicants, and they are okay waiting. If they are awarded, which is how we will do everybody else, we will do that, what we call a risk assessment as part of the administrative review,
mm-hmm.
right before we do the contracts. That way not everybody's having to submit all of their information in advance, when it's only a couple of agencies that usually...
So but at some point, if agency XYZ puts in all of that effort, but then we find out that they can't meet by the requirements,
then that funding won't become available, and they'll be in the discussion that, hey, we had this $50,000 that was not anticipated, and then you can decide where to.
Okay.
Usually it'll go down to the next available project, because you'll notice there's a lot of extra money or a lot of
extra
requests for the funding that we have.
So, right off the top, this community roots collaborative
mm-hmm.
around 5 years.
I'm sorry?
Has it been around 5 years?
No, they've only been in 2 or 3 years, and that doesn't disqualify them. That's the thing. And even we looked at the agency,
sure.
we did a cursory look to make sure that we weren't having them in a
beautiful
application. But.
I mean, I think it's a really interesting group, so I'll express my bias now. So in the case where they haven't been there for 5 years, would it mean that finance would recommend against, but you would override it?
No, not necessarily.
So we have yet to have an agency not go through.
Well,
but
it could happen. It could absolutely happen. And it isn't just finance. What we do is what we call a cross-functional team meeting, where you have finance, you have the auditor, you have us, and you have contracting there. And then we look at all the documents they submit, and we do a scored risk assessment.
Okay.
You know, and
sure.
and based on that, you know, you get, I don't know, like I'm
70.
I'm making up, like, yeah, I mean, I don't remember that, you know, like, if it, is it above 70, you know, above 80, above 90 to determine if it's a low risk, you know, higher number, lower risk,
sure.
you know, lower number, higher risk. And then it's like, ooh, are we, you know, if it's below a threshold, then it turns into a discussion of, do we really want to fund this?
Where did they score really low? Is that just technical assistance that we can easily provide and that's not a problem? Or is there an actual deficiency in the agency that makes it so we can't?
And that's a process that we get audited on,
yeah.
by
sure.
the way. You know, when we have the state auditor's office, they look at our risk assessment process.
And there's still a minimum amount that people have to show in their budgets before they can apply, right?
There's a minimum request amount, which is $45,000, not what their budget is.
So a small upcoming agency, someone that's been around for, say, 5 years, or they don't have a large budget, can you explain to the group how they stand?
So we fund two agencies that we are a major funding portion of their entire budget already. So that's not, do they have the financial practices in place? Do they have the infrastructure in place to be able to meet the reporting requirements, the financial requirements? That's what we're looking for. So
yeah.
It can be small agencies.
But what you're talking about in terms of the threshold is the county policy on requests for proposals and for contracting is there is a minimum amount to propose. So is it 35 or 40? I think it's...
We do 45.
45,000. So, you know, so... we're not going to consider Well, I think that the county contracting amount is, I believe, 35.
Possibly, yeah.
So for the RFA is a 45, you know, just based on the scale and the scope of services that we need to do. So you can be an agency, a 1-2 person agency, and the proposal you're making be a major source of financing for that agency, but we're not going to consider, we're not going to go through all this work and all this contracting for a $2,000 contract.
So
yeah.
We're running really far behind.
Yep.
Any feedback on having everybody review, or do we want to create teams and split them in half?
What are people's thoughts? When does that decision have to be made?
So we are hoping to open up access to the applications to the board in January.
Okay.
So we would need to make a final. I think we could do a final decision at the January.
At the January.
So
okay.
Keep that in mind. I'll send out an email
follow-up.
Also.
We just need to think about it at this point, and then we'll make a final decision on that at the January meeting. Does that sound like a plan?
So if it's teams, a team would only do a few.
Some
team
of them.
Would do
right.
Some.
As opposed to all of us doing it all of them.
Okay.
Very good. Moving on, we've got to be mindful of time.
So the January, I'm so sorry, Lee, I was looking at you.
Okay, so, and actually, Rebecca, you're up next.
So the January meeting, just to give you a heads up, well, it's going to be the same style as we did last year. Where the morning we'll do business type, and that's what Bridget, I'll make sure there's time on the agenda for you for the advocacy folders. And then in the afternoon, we're going to do training. Kate and I are getting together to do a lot of the different training aspects for the board regarding going over the RFA process. So you'll really have an idea of, oh, here's the question. What are the things I should be looking for in this type of question? What best practices, what they mean, so that when they're talking about those, you have a better understanding of what those best practices are, what they should be looking like, not what the agency might think it should be looking like. So we'll do the afternoon of a lot of trainings, but it's really going to be RFA focused on the different aspects that you guys are meeting. And then I confirmed that we have the Leif Jensen Bud Bank Leave Room that we used last year at the sports complex, so that is where the meeting will take place.
That cool octagon building,
yeah.
If you guys are
familiar. January 15th.
January 8th.
Okay. Michael, we don't have a lot of time, but
nope.
I, for one, am really interested in the finance report. So.
No worries. And I actually, as soon as I'm done with this, I have to leave to a different meeting. But I'm going to start with, well, first of all, what to look for on both of these is the far right column in percentage spent. What you really want to see is that they're in between like the 30s and the 60% spent out, just based on where we are in our contracting year. You know, in both of these sheets, overall, all the agencies are where they need to be. Where I want to draw your attention, not because and everything's fine, it is where they need to be. But where you're going to see a difference in that is in the 2017-2019 CHG-HEN and ESG fund sheet. This sheet right here, the shaded part. That's generally under share, you're going to see a bunch of percentage spent of 100%. And you're going to be, and you likely should be thinking, like, wait a minute, if it's a 2017 to 19 period that we're talking about here, why are we already 100% spent out? And the reason for that, the reality is they're not. These are ESG, the Emergency Solutions Grant contracts. And what you may recall from discussion in prior meetings, the Department of Commerce contacted us and asked us if we would like to for them to remove all the ESG funding and replace that ESG funding with CHG, like State Consolidated Homelessness. So all the ESG funds, the contracts have been modified, and those ESG funds have been removed. So the Emergency Solutions Grant funds are 100% spent out. That's why that 100% is there. That's a good thing, because Emergency Solutions Grant funds are federal HUD funds that are very restrictive and not very flexible in how we can use them, which is why we jumped on when Commerce asked us if we were willing. We said, please, take it all, as long as it's being, you know, it's a one-for-one replacement. Because the Consolidated Homelessness Grant funds they were replaced with are you know, much, much more flexible.
Good.
So those funds will be coming in, you know, they're going to be contracted in with, you know, with future mods. So, you know, so that's, you know, that's what I want to draw your attention to.
So
go ahead.
The next financial report should take this green shaded total balance of contract and shift it into CHG funds.
So they're already there. So the first three are the ESG contracts that are now spent out 100%, and then
the next three
are those programs just with
CHG. You see at 28, and I did not explain that very well, so thank you, Bridget,
so
Braxton, Dan, and Rebecca. So yes, so what you see here is the transition in itself.
Yeah,
so
that's why those are 29%.
For example, we've got 133 plus 405, which gives us a balance on the contract of 486. Mm-hmm. I mean, not that it's a straight add.
Yes.
Correct.
But it should be pretty much straight,
yeah.
I mean,
okay.
Pennies off.
Yes.
I got it.
Yes.
And we had to create brand new contracts because you can't just modify a contract and take out those requirements. We had to cancel those ESG contracts completely and recreate a new contract.
So,
dollars.
So what she's talking about is by law, you know, in contracting law, if we just modified the contract, removing the ESG funds and replacing with CHG funds, because it's the same contract that had already been, you know, the federal dollars had already touched, we'd have to treat the CHG dollars in the same way.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, they would not be flexible. So, in order to take advantage of the flexibility, we had to actually create a whole new contract number.
Sure.
You know, that's...
Yep. Makes sense.
But the big goal is that everybody is on track to spend, so we're at that approximately 50% out of the 18 of contracts. So we are, everybody's in there. They're doing it.
And what you can see, and if you look at, like, in both sheets, if you look for the yellow summer, like the yellow line in terms of totals, what you're going to see is on the community funds, the house bills, the local dollars, we're at 49.95% spent. So we're halfway through. That's good. And with the state and federal funding, the smaller spreadsheet, we're 57% spent out. So, which is good, and it's generally anticipated. There's a little bit of overlap in terms of the services between these two contracts. So we're not going to be running out of money before we need to on the state and federal side.
Okay.
One last
yep.
thing. I know we're in a rush. Is there is going to be a change coming to future finance reports. You want to talk about that?
So we've been talking as staff, trying to, we've heard the feedback where the reports are very confusing, so we want to try to make them better. Every time we're always looking to make them better. So it probably won't happen until the new RFAs are established, but the quarterly reports and the finance reports, we're going to modify them a little bit and have them set up, instead of by specifically a funding source, we're going to set them up by category, like we're doing the RFA. So we'll have
community
one report
action.
That's community action, one report that's homeless crisis response system. I hope that will help with some of the confusion. There's a lot of programs, so it's no matter what we do, I think there's going to be a little bit of confusion, but we're constantly trying to work towards less confusion on the reports that we provide. So that'll be one change that you'll see coming up. Probably not until the RFA is done.
I don't know how you keep track of all.
So I apologize, but I have to run to another meeting at VHA. One last thing, you know, while Kelly, you know, largely, not just because Kelly is gone, just be aware we are incredibly stretched thin right now. We have the workday, the main county finance system transition happening now, like between now and March, which is incredibly work intensive for all of us. In fact, no program coordinator or manager is allowed to take vacation even in February. Or
what exactly is that?
Workday is a software that the county uses for finances.
Okay.
Yeah. So we have that going on. We have the four RFAs that are currently happening.
Two here and two in our unit for other funding.
Yeah, yes. Yes, we have additional RFAs happening in other parts. So just be aware, we are stretched thin and below our usually staffing, you know, probably the most since I've been here. So, but anyway, thank you. And
well, thank you guys for all the hard work you're doing behind the scenes to make it look easy, because we don't know all the stuff you guys do, but thank you.
So how often do you get these reports?
Twice a year. So in May and in November.
And how often do we get those reports which say the numbers we've served?
The quarterly report. The outcome report is four times. So they're quarterly, and then we try to bring them at the next.
So is it a huge amount of work to print these out? Like, I think it would really help to get those at the same time each time. Because you
to make
the questions
so
you
the reason
always have about outcomes. And which funding is this on?
The reason that we do it separately is the org standards. We love those org standards. They require that at every regular meeting, we have both a program update and a quarterly, or a program update and a financial update. And so the way we've been able to make the six meetings work is during the, when we have those two times, we have the quarterly reports four times, so that's four plus two makes six. And then we throw in some sort of program training or with Renata being here, that will be considered a program update because you're learning about what our programs are expected to do. And it meets the requirement for the org standards to have a program and a financial update at every single meeting. So
can we just get all of this at every meeting? I mean,
so I don't have quarterly reports ready.
No, but in the future, I mean, is that a possibility?
So Rhonda would not be, that does take a whole lot of time to prepare.
Okay.
So what she
does,
which I didn't even know until this time, is she actually pulls every single contract to make sure that she has all of them correctly, because we do a lot of modifications, like with ESG throughout the time. So she actually spends several hours preparing just that one.
Okay, that was my question. If it was just mechanical...
No,
and both at
the
same
system
time
does not work as easily as we would like it to work. So
okay.
We would love our already
strips.
So now we know why is that.
Yeah.
Not? Okay. So we have got to roll forward because our dear Renata has waited patiently, and I am so sorry that
that's okay.
But
I can always come back.
Please share with us and do your thing. Thank you, Renata.
All right. So kind of zip through it. So which one has it go? This one? Okay. So trauma-informed care, and some of you have been through my clinic before, Rebecca being one. I'm the chief operations officer for Mills and Mills People, and we have some centers on this side of the river, as well as in Washington and Multnomah County. This is my second agency that we decided to become trauma-informed care agency, so I'll talk about like what it means and how to do it. I know I only have 35 minutes, but we'll try to go through like overview of what trauma-informed care means, and then ask me questions as we go, because it's easier than roadmap to sustainability, because yes, it's nice to say we're gonna be trauma-informed care agency, but there's the steps you need to take to become one and then maintain being one, and how to become a trauma-informed care provider. So basically there's a common language throughout the agency is the idea of the concept, because we recognize that the signs and symptoms of trauma with the people that we serve, including our staff providing the service, is really problem and it's out there. So this is also, I want to disclose, not to say that we did not provide the services correctly up until this moment. This is just to say like we can maybe do certain things better or more advanced and more client-centered. Whether you call them client consumers, I'm not really sure. In this.
Participants. I think all of the above.
We realized that the widespread impact of trauma and that we all have something, some more than others. So we just realized that it's out there and recognize that there is a path to recovery if we provide our services in a certain trauma-informed care way. And then respond in integrating the knowledge into the policies and procedures. And that's where, as trauma-informed care agency, that is really
the key element that everybody is on board, and then we're designing all the policies and procedures and ways how we practice our services into the one way. And then, of course, to resist the re-traumatization. Lots of our participants come to us and they don't necessarily view us as the helpers, because they may have bad experiences with similar agencies or other government agencies. And so we try to really look at the system as a whole and see where are we re-traumatizing people. But it is like unbearable amount of paperwork that people have to fill out, going many places, not knowing what to bring, what to do, and it's things like that. So traumatic events could be anything, and I'm sure this list is not complete, but that's just to list some. And we really, when we talk about trauma-informed care, we're talking about prolonged trauma that is happening to somebody over the lifetime. And it's usually done by people that they trust, usually happen earlier in their childhood, but it can really happen anytime. We don't necessarily need to know what the event was from our participant. We're just going to kind of, the concept is we're just going to assume that something in their past may have caused certain traumatic events that they're dealing with. So there was the ACE study. Anybody familiar? Adverse Childhood Experience. So Kaiser enrolled about 17,000 adults. Actually, they were predominantly white and over 45 years of age. I think that was just coincidence. At the time, it was late 80s, and it's cumulative score based on 10 questions. Usually, I have the 10 questions that I give out, then bring it. Mm-hmm. Yes.
The 10 questions are actually in the back of the folder everybody got earlier. This just
So yes, take a look at that. They're fairly simple questions, like, did any of your caregivers were divorced? Were they incarcerated? I mean, kind of common life experiences. And include some physical trauma, but it's not limited to that. The what was really interesting to the people that actually did this, that two-thirds, which is the majority of the people asked, had at least one or more experiences from that list. And 10% had scored four or more. What they found out then after that is, like, if people score four or more on that list, they were twice as likely to smoke, 12 times as likely to have attempted suicide, maybe be an alcoholic, or injected street drugs. So they kind of, the whole concept is like there's an adverse childhood experience that happened. After that is, and that could be at any age, but they say the most formative age is like 0 to 5, used to be 0 to 3, now some research says it's 0 to 5. Now that doesn't mean that it cannot be corrected. And actually, the younger the child is, the better chances with right intervention that we can really reverse the traumatic experience throughout some early childhood interventions. That's why, like, the early childhood programs are really important. I don't know if you guys have any. So those are, because those can make the most difference for the future. Then there's kind of like disruptive neurodevelopment, social, emotional, and cognitive impairment, which falls by like adoption of high-risk behaviors, whether it's smoking, prostitution, could be anything. And then lots of like disease, disability, and early death. Well, not to be all depressing here. Because there is hope, and with right intervention, we really, and right services and right approaches, we really can make a difference how people perceive and go. So the missing base actually in the ACE model is that it didn't take into into account, like, the poverty, which could be traumatizing in its own, especially if you go generation after generation, current and past community trauma, institutionalized oppression, microaggressions, intergenerational transmission of trauma. Those would be like, you know, like, grandma was poor, mother was poor, and so, yeah, what's there for me? And then trauma inflicted by systems, and whether it's a foster care system or when people are incarcerated, like each system has certain ways, or mental health system, that they continue inflicting trauma on their participants if they're not careful. Sorry. So the people may present, like, we all know the participants, and I don't know how many of you actually work in direct service with participants, but it's like people may seem like spacey or out of it and have difficulty to remember things. And this is when, and my background being like not just Mills and Mills, but many years before that in housing. So this is more like the clients that you tell them 3 times what they need to bring for their next appointment, and they're still going to walk in without it. And it's almost like, oh my gosh, I wrote it down, I told you. And so really the good way to, all people learn or remember different ways. So since we don't know what that person been through, we try to use different modes of how to let them know what it is that is required. So we tell them, we write it down for them, and this is where you really need to have a staff to do that, but follow up with a phone call. Just like the doctor's appointment, like they call you the day before. Remember, you have appointment at 1 o'clock, and this is, you need to bring your card and everything. And I actually found out that actually works. It helps people remember. Some of us get annoyed, like, of course I know I have an appointment, it's on my calendar, right? But it really helps maybe 9 out of 10 people. If they didn't get that phone call, maybe they would miss that appointment. Complaints that the system is unfair. We all know people when they say it's always everybody else's fault but theirs. And that's because they're just are naturally combative without work, because their previous experiences that didn't go that well. Makes appointment and doesn't show up. That is like some people, and from my like housing times, I used to work with clients that I knew I will not make morning appointments. Because I know I'm setting them up, there's no way this person can show up at 9 a.m. so anywhere. So knowing that, I'm trying to get later appointments or afternoon appointments. Not to say that that person will never change, but maybe we need to do a little bit more work to get them where we need to be. It's 20 years ago, we had an employment program. We had people who wouldn't show up for the morning classes or something, just to find out, well, now everybody has it, but back then they didn't, that they didn't have an alarm clock. So it's the simple things that when we're trying to figure out what is it that it takes to get that person functioning to where they're not missing their appointments, doing what they need to do so they don't, we have this word that I don't like, and it's not trauma-informed, like sabotage themselves, because they're not doing it on purpose, most likely. Because if you ask somebody, like, do they really want to be unsuccessful, you're not going to get the answer, yeah, that's what I'm aiming for. So it's like, I do everything for that. It's, we're assuming that everybody wants to be successful, everybody wants to get where they need to be. Some of people just need extra help to do that and get there. And we did these trainings with Vancouver Housing Authority, and we helped them go through their processes, like intake and stuff, and found some places where we can make, they can make some little changes to make people more successful and not be dropping off the list or not having all the paperwork. Because the when you think about what the amount of paperwork you have to fill out just to get into housing program, it's horrendous. And then some people cannot handle it. So can you split the appointment in two or three times so you don't do it all at once? Do you have a place where the three-year-old or five-year-old can safely be while you're doing it and not constantly like talking to you while you're trying to do this, right? And so it's some of the things are little things that we can adjust and will make whole difference in the world, how that experience will happen and what the success is going to be after that. So that's the really goal of this looking through a trauma lens. Doesn't tell truth. Most people will not lie on purpose, I believe. I might be wrong. But it's like lots of people have experience with the system, so many of them think they know what you want to hear. And they try to adjust that, where that may not be true or was true 20 years ago, but not today. So help people like answer the questions as truthfully as possible and change their mind, what they want, and or cannot make up their mind. Like the severe trauma survivors really have a hard time making decisions. Even simple decision like do you want red or blue pajamas is difficult. So helping people make decisions, not making them for them, but maybe help them get to the point like looking for the pros and cons, basically make decisions. So it's really making it possible for participants to participate in their own care. And I want to stress that because it really doesn't mean like we know what's best for people and that's how we design the plan. It's really helping people finding out, well, first of all, gaining the trust, finding out where they want to be, where they want to go, and then help them design the plan according to that. So we take into account that everybody who walks through our door has some type of trauma behind them, so they have some challenges doing what they need to do in order to be successful in one of our programs. Again, we don't want to know what it is, although some people will disclose in the first meeting everything you didn't want to know, but helping them kind of steer towards not to do that. We're going to avoid triggering trauma reaction or re-traumatizing people. And again, this could be done in many different ways. So we did some training, I think it was Scania coming. And what they found out when we looked at it, like what can we change? Sometimes there's a change of space. Like if your space where you're providing services is not welcoming to people, people are not going to feel good, and it's like the first turn off. So in their office, as you walk in, the receptionist was sitting, don't ask me why, with the back to the door. So you're walking in, and you see a back of the person, and it was struck me off when I first walked in. Maybe she's just turned. So I'm like, hey, what if you guys just turn the desk around, and the receptionist is actually facing the door and can smile and greet people as they come in? So that was fairly simple fix. Didn't cost any money. I think they had to buy a desk or something because it was like permanent. But it was fairly cheap and fixable. The other one is like doing the paperwork differently, breaking it to the small steps. Anything big is overwhelming to anybody. So if you think that this takes too long, or having paperwork signed, like here is the release, here is this, here is that, here is the eligibility, sign here, sign here, sign here, without even people understanding what they're signing, could be problematic. So, and we're so used to it everywhere, even in like doctor's office, that we don't even think about it. But you can give people choices. And another thing is the choices. Like, people need to have choice. And there's always two choices, minimum of two choices, is yes and no, right? So as much choices as we can offer, the better results that can be. We do need to do it as an organization. It doesn't help to do it just like department. It's like you as an organization have to make a decision that this is how we want to do it. And I can tell, like, by as many training as I did in this area, is like people are wanting to do that. So, and help them basically making that access and retainment benefits from the services at a maximum. So basically it's like we recognize trauma informed care, the naturalist, we recognize that trauma creates fear, powerlessness, and sense of worthlessness. So as much as we can encourage people and help them be where they need to be, the better. Commitment wherever possible is repeating those experiences. So let's make sure they're not intimidating. The another example could be like if you walk in the waiting room and there's a bunch of signs, don't do this, prohibiting this and that. So really be cautious. I always tell people like look at your signs in your waiting rooms. Do all of them have to be there? And then just because you put something on the sign, do people really follow it? And then how it makes people feel. So basically create a safe context, restore power and self-worth, and value the individual. As we said, like the individuals, they all gonna come with something else. So the culture of TIC, if you wanna be trauma-informed care agency. And by the way, we get like, in my first agency, we get dive into it deep, like about 12 years ago, and it took us about 4 years to fix all the aspects. So I'm not saying this happens overnight, and it really depends on the commitment of the agencies, like how much of this do you really want to do? And this is just like total quick overview. Normally our trainings are about 2.5-3 hours long and have different portion of it. We always encourage the agencies having inside in-house trainers because as the new people are coming on board, like they're getting trained and there's like clear training plan, how it's going and when and how is everybody going to get trained. It's not that hard to get trained. You don't have to be an expert. We do share our PowerPoint easily. It's not copyrighted. So it's easy to follow. So, but it involves all aspects of the program activities, setting, relationship, and atmosphere. This is where in agency we realize we have to involve and train our people in physical department, which at first doesn't make sense because they don't deal with clients on a day-to-day basis. They really are on the background. But what we found out, they really didn't understand them creating more paperwork for us was really affecting the clients. So just sit down with them, train them, and then sit down with them and it's like, really, do you need this? Because we're already doing it here. You know how when you go somewhere, you fill out your name, date of birth, and income like 5 different times on 5 different papers? And it's like, yes. You need a signature when you provide client assistance. That's a given. It's money, right? But do you need a signature on just the info sheet with name and date of birth and all that? So it really took like whole aspects. And for some of it, we were surprised. Like we would never think of training fiscal people, honestly. I mean, it's just like, it's just issuing checks, right? So that was kind of few of the surprises. Involves, and that's where it goes, like involves all the groups, like the administrators, the supervisors, the staff, and clients. We also pull a group of clients together and ask them, what is it about our service that you don't like, or what do we do well, what do we don't? And we did adjusted some changes according to what we heard. Like, we used to have, like, under no circumstances we change in case manager. You just, you know, work it out. Well, turn out that's what they hated the most, because guess what? Sometimes people don't click. So it's like, if you are forced to be, and our, some of our housing program at the time were up to 2 years long. So if you're stuck with one person 2 years, that, for example, reminds you of your abuser, that's not going to work really well. So our rigidity of not changing, because another best practice was you don't change staff, right? So it's like, how to find the balance between the two? Like, yes, we know that changing the staff is not super beneficial, but on the other hand, if it doesn't work, it's kind of like, if you go to hairdresser and you get really bad haircut, you're not going to go back and try to work out the differences, so hoping next time it's going to turn out better, right? You're going to find somebody else. So it's kind of the same thing. It's like getting little flexibility in what we do. Of course, especially in housing, there's lots of rules and federal rules. Like, some of it you cannot change, you cannot bend, but could you approach it differently or different side or something? Involves making trauma-informed change into more informed way of thinking and acting. So this is where the trainings come in. Like, if all the staff is trained, they start thinking about, like, okay, so maybe this isn't the best way of doing it, or why are we doing this? We had lots of staff come to me like, really, how many times are we going to ask them the same question on five different papers? So yes, it's lots of work. Then you have to pull people together and see, like, what we can drop, what we cannot. You have to talk to your funder, and the funder is becoming better and better, is my experience now, because they understand now, so whatever they can do, they will. At least in Clyde County, my experience. Multnomah County, not so much. So, and then commitment to an ongoing process of self-assessment. It was the hardest part, probably, was like we did the assessment of an agency. There's a set of questions that you ask, like agency, the clients you serve, and the staff, the lower staff and the executive staff. It was really interesting to get the results once we did that, like what people, some of the perceptions, like we found out that some staff didn't feel safe in their environment. It never crossed my mind that somebody could feel unsafe. So we did, and that was because we didn't have the doors secured. But nobody thought of it till we did the assessment. Commitment, and then constant feedback from the clients, staff and clients. Your best feedback really will come from the people you serve and from the direct staff that serves the people. Nobody is going to give you better feedback about the services, because we can see and look at it, but we're just not going to see it. We're not going through it on day in, day out. So, how to sustain the program, something like that, is agency commitment, training and support, service delivery, and system change and monitoring. So, agency commitment, like leadership is really invested into this. There is a budget for TIC, and it could be minimal or it could be more. It depends what you as an agency find important. There also is lots of grants to implement trauma-informed care. That's how we did K-Butts. Mm-hmm. What was it, like four counties?
Yeah, it was the three community action agencies.
Yeah. That was the grant from Commerce, mm-hmm. I think, yeah.
The innovation grant.
And everybody got trained and all at once in 1 year, and we trained the trainers, and hopefully, I don't know how it's going, mm-hmm. but hopefully it's going. Feedback, as we talk about, workforce wellness is a priority, and this is something that in my current agency we really strive. So we're constantly asking staff. They have many ways to express what they would like, what they wouldn't. And we always, as an executive team, looking at it and changing whatever we can and is feasible. This is how we established like the wellness program this year, because people were asking, yeah, you want us to live like healthy and stuff, but it costs money. So everybody now has access to $100 a year that each staff member that they either can use for like their gym membership or buying tennis shoes for running or Fitbit or whatever they decide. I think we only had one denial. One person wanted it for facial. So other than that, we paid pretty much for everything that people wanted as far as wellness. And I know Cher has that too, I think, here. So, but we wouldn't know that if we didn't ask, because this wasn't something on our radar. Commitment to equity and diversity is all the staff and clients feeling safe and secure and valued and respected. Training and support, again, like everybody has to be like from board to volunteers, trained, like this is what we as an entity would like to accomplish. Hiring and onboarding, we do have time and fun care questions on our hiring question, one of our hiring questions, because we do want to know up front, like even though you don't know what it means, you can ask certain questions to know where these people have similar approach to what you're looking for. And then once they're on board, they do get the training within, I think we have it within like first 3 to 6 months, they get the basic trauma-informed care training. Supervision, trauma-informed care supervision, very important. Having the regular supervision meetings, the direct staff with the supervisor, we were not so good about it way back when. Just like, yeah, my door is open, come anytime. Well, you have people that would come anytime, and then you have people you will never see. So really taking into account, like, we all are different, and scheduling maybe regular times, whether it's once a week, or what we do is, like, if somebody is brand new hire, they would get once a week an hour, and then as we move on, it's like once every 2 weeks, and it could be for more seasonal staff, like once a month, and some of it could be like, as we are all different, I have staff who wants to meet with me every other week, regular time, regular place, and then I have people, yeah, I'll find you if I need them, and that's fine too. So like knowing who we're working with and really providing that support. Human resources, policies, and practices, like so we don't go against what we're trying to accomplish. We did have to review our handbook, employee handbook, because we had some stuff in there. You know, like it's established and then nobody looks at it. You read it when you first hired, maybe, a little bit, and then it goes somewhere in the drawer, right? So we don't... We really had to made a conscious effort to look at our handbook and see how outdated it was, and make some fixes. Now we have it like online kind of, and it's easy to just pulling up like policy by policy and replacing it and revising it. So it's easier now. Staff training, we do have a training calendar and tracking, and all the staff has to go through the same training within a certain period of time. So the trauma-informed care trainings, we have series of 6, which includes the self-care and home visits and understanding conflict. Can't even think of everything. All with, and then specifically working with seniors, obviously, because that's what we do. And so that's like our core trainings they have to do in the first year. And we offer it on a regular basis with our in-house trainers, which is me and one other person. So it's not like we have a team or anything. And then and then some additional trainings, because every training we do the evaluation, and people do list like what other trainings they would like to see, and then so we'll go from there. And then we have some non-mandatory voluntary trainings if they want to go. And the last year we opened it to all of our volunteers. So any trainings we provide for the staff, it's also open to volunteers, board members, and everybody. So they can choose to come and do it with the staff. And it's actually really great because you get to know the board members and staff and everybody. And then workforce wellness and safety, you should review your safety and incidents that are happening. I'm sure you have safety committee or something. That something happened, what steps do we need to take so it doesn't happen again, or was it just a fluke? Service delivery, again, welcome and safe environment. Client engagement, of course, we want participants to be engaged in their own planning and process. So, again, one shoe does not fit all. We have to kind of adjust to what people need. Family-informed care procedures, again, it's reviewing procedures at least once a year to see, like, did we miss anything or did things change or this doesn't apply anymore or however we need to adjust. Client choice, again, the more choices we can give, the better it is. System change and monitoring, sustained process. So we constantly have to monitor ourselves. Are we doing what we say we're doing? Now, training would take place for a lot of it, but that's just like part of it. Again, reviewing, maybe doing the self-assessment. Honestly, we cannot do it once a year. It's a big process. It takes lots of time, and you really would have to have a person dedicated to it, which most nonprofits don't have. But as much as it could be a quick Survey Monkey thing about one or two teams. Communication, the biggest complaint ever by any employee is, you don't communicate enough with me. And I would say, well, I send you an email. You don't read them. And so again, it has to be different modes of communication, whether it's a staff meeting, some people process that way, email, and I don't know how many emails people get, but yes, it's really, this is like my time zone.
You have, you're fine, you have 4 minutes.
I'm almost at the end, I'm really sped it up. So, communication is really tough one. We did not find the silver bullet for communication, I have to say. We try different modes, but you always can have at least few people say you don't communicate enough. And what is enough, I'm not really quite sure. But evaluation and feedback loop, like in our agency, all people are evaluated at the same time in May. And then there's a merit system. We made it way more tangible. So the goals are really clear. What is the expectation now? And people are very clear, like, how is it you can get the raise? Like, this is what you need to do. This is how you need to perform. And it's very tangible. And I have to say, that was one of the hardest things to do. Because evaluations could be so subjective. Like, it depends, like, yeah, you're this person this way or that way, but to really come together, and it took a long time. And again, the feedback loop. After that, I just have like kind of like a work plan, like a sample how it may look like. I will not go through that.
We have some copies that we are so impressed with this. And so
thank you.
We actually included statements for agencies showing their treatment of other consumers with dignity and respect in our RFA consideration. So this assessment piece is...
And this looks like the same.
I think
it could be, because we do this, like, we did this training, we're doing it for, like, AAA jurisdiction. I mean, we did it all over Clark County, so I'm not really sure. And again, we're leaving always the PowerPoint, so I'm sure people.
Yeah,
and yes, use it.
I will send this out.
Yeah, it looks
so
very
that the board has
yeah.
this PowerPoint.
It's going to be one of ours. Yeah.
Yeah.
Do
you have that? I think isn't it in the email? I will always take a hard copy if you don't need this one.
You can have that.
Okay.
I got one of them. I'm so impressed with this. I mean, this is so right on target with what
right.
we need.
And this is just a really like short overview. Like as I said, we have a series of training that I can email that we do. We have a nonprofit rate.
Awesome. Wow.
But really, the goal is like somebody internally from the agency sit through enough training that they can do themselves, and then it doesn't cost anything. So. Or minimum.
Well, and you know, I always go back to DMV. Remember back in the day where if you had to go to DMV, it was you're taking a day off work
right.
and it was going to be hell, right? But now you go to DMV, you get a number, you're in
yeah.
out in 20 minutes sometimes. I mean, it's okay.
Yeah.
Give or take.
The number, yes, the 20 minutes, that didn't happen to me ever.
I have. I mean, it's.
I believe that.
But really, when we think about just the systems and the
right.
structures that we put in place, even as something as simple as that.
Oh, simple. Really, some of it is super
yeah.
simple.
Yeah.
You just have to ask people.
Mm-hmm.
So,
awesome.
You built in lots of feedback related to self assessment or organization,
uh-huh.
looking at it, self assessment.
Or like simple survey.
So, how do you get feedback from your participants or clients or customers, whatever, that what you put in place is really good?
So we do surveys, like right now we have like our congregate dining and our home delivered
mm-hmm.
meals that
mm-hmm.
we do.
Mm-hmm.
And we do a survey like once a year, like our big survey, and we get about 2,500 surveys. In that time. And we asked like 5 questions that we thought was important and all has to do with, and they're all like trauma-informed care kind of approach, all has to do with the service, with the friendliness and approach, and we leave like 2 questions for their comments that they can put anything, what they want. Now, most of ours, of course, can be about the food, and guess what? You cannot please people with food, because if it's spicy, it's too spicy for one and not spicy enough for somebody else. If you have not enough pork, I don't eat pork. So it's like, when you pull out the food comments,
right.
and of course, if we have like common one, then we look at it. That's how we replace our like really bad chicken with a better chicken. But that was help with the survey because everybody, that chicken is really nasty. Okay. So we don't use that purveyor anymore. We buy it somewhere else. And it's better because next survey was better. But it's like overall, the other ones, it's like this is when we do like once a year. However, the whole year, our grievance process is super clear. We keep track of it. So no matter what kind of complaint we get, either it's phone call or in writing, and giving people different modes of how they can respond, like how anonymous they want to be. So we do the survey monkeys that are anonymous, and for those, our population doesn't use computer as much as the younger population, but there are some. They can write letter, anonymous letter. They can make a phone call if a particular person, and we have like really strict processes how it goes, and the response is happening A, within 24 hours from the time we receive it, and then B, the whole grievance process is happening within 5 to 10 days.
What? How often do you get a grievance?
Oh, it depends.
Mm-hmm. Couple times a year or a lot?
Oh no, it's way more than that.
Oh, okay.
It's like, and again, like some of it is just the food. Those
sure.
are the easy one,
sure.
right? Because we can always talk about that. But there is some about staff, and then we investigate.
Okay.
And then it's like we find that like some of it is valid, some of it is not.
Mm-hmm.
Again, then we're looking for a pattern. Is this staff having multiple complaints from multiple people, that's a red flag, right? If it's just one, maybe that person doesn't like them or they didn't let them do what they wanted.
Sure.
So it's like it takes commitment from the management to really resolve this in a timely manner. Because one of the biggest complaints we got when we did the original assessment is like, I never hear back from you. So it's like we really committed ourselves to that's not going to be the statement. And I think we kind of nipped that one.
Do you notice a difference in the number of grievances between the Meals on Wheels program and, say, the housing programs that you were involved with before?
Yes, we get way more in Meals.
Yeah.
People have time, and it's not a, you know.
That is one. Yeah. And then housing, whether you like it or not, people still are afraid to say anything,
right,
especially if they're getting subsidy.
Yep.
This is what I was telling my case managers in housing always, like, you don't realize it, but you have power over your client.
Over whether they're warm or not.
Right.
Like,
or whether they have
right.
a roof over their head.
Yeah.
It's like, that's how they view you. You may not see yourself that way, but I bet the people
yeah.
who are getting service from you, they do.
Yeah.
So it's much harder to solicit feedback from housing people, I would say, than our seniors.
Mm-hmm. Well, you're not going to tell your boss, you know, you're
right.
Because the boss might fire you. And so
right, that's why the opportunity for making it anonymous.
Mm-hmm.
In housing, we used to have volunteers that would call our participants and explain, like, but that still doesn't instill trust, you know? Like,
right.
who can be on that other end? And are they going to write my name?
Right.
They know my phone number. So it's like, it is more challenging to get it from housing clients.
So I work for the housing authorities. I was in the training initially. One of the programs that I manage, you work with families towards self-sufficiency. And after we did your training, we looked at all of the policies and procedures that we have in place for our housing programs. And we decided, let's not only like dissect each one of these and see where we can make changes to them, but let's bring in participants from the program to show us what is working and what's not working. And then the Housing Authority in general has employed community health workers
mm-hmm.
who are residents of the Housing Authority to provide that exact feedback
mm-hmm.
on how we're doing even in the housing realm or the application
mm-hmm.
and the community itself. And that, I think, has been the biggest feedback loop
yep.
From those who represent.
Yep.
Their job is really to go out and ask the other people,
mm-hmm.
how is the Housing Authority doing? And because they're residents, they're not in fear of telling another
right.
resident, this is how I truly feel, and we're getting the honest feedback. So
right,
when I think when we look at some of these applications, it would be neat to see any element of that where there's participants or people in the program who are providing feedback.
Does that go to all of your clients that you're serving in all programs across the board?
Most, yes, in my program, yes, but in housing in general, we have one for an education advocate for parents with small kids age
sure.
0 to 18, and then we have ones with disability, and we have seniors as well.
Okay, good.
So I thought you looked familiar. I'm glad you guys
awesome.
Learned that, because you guys were great. I loved the time.
Renata, thank you so much.
It
was incredibly valuable
know.
For all of us. And
yeah.
I'll sorry about the time mix-up.
No,
it's fine. So we got to get things rolling here. We are completely out of time. But we wanted to, well, first open forum. Does anyone have anything to bring up? Okay. And then work plan ideas, Rebecca?
So I'm drafting next year's work plan, and we usually do that on the calendar year. And so I have a couple of ideas that I was thinking of. This year we really focused on a lot of trainings to get prepared for the RFA. And so next year we're going to be in transition between programs, so I was wondering if we wanted to kind of take a step back, slow down our meetings, really focus on just the work that we have and not have all these like additional trainings. At this time, I think there's still a couple of trainings I could find to have come in and do provide for the board if you're interested. And then have this year maybe be all of our meetings are very rushed. And so if we took out some of these components, we might be able to enjoy the meetings a little bit more and take time on topics that we haven't had before. I can still do trainings if you'd like. We can still keep focusing on that, and I can do more trainings through the year. And then I thought for 2020, our programs, our new ones that are have been funded, will be established, and then we can start bringing them back in on a regular basis to do their program presentation.
I think, I mean, first off the cuff, we don't have time for a big discussion, but I think just that is worth talking about. I think that all of us probably have two cents to say about it. But another thing that we've talked about was having, going to an every month meeting, but having the every other month be the operations, and then have us be able to do a visit at a site for on those every other
months. Every, there are requirements that we have to meet at every specific, if we have a monthly meeting, so that's fine, staff will support that. But there are specific items that we have to do at every meeting. So we will be able to.
January discussion.
Yeah.
And your program does too, because we're not enough of us here to really
give
the input you need, because you, I know you're working on it then.
Can we put that on the agenda for discussion time in January?
Yeah.
Okay. Because we'll have plenty of time on that day, hopefully. We have to make time.
Rather than having outside training, my interest would be in taking the Council of Homeless overall plan, strategic thing they do.
The homeless action plan?
Yeah. And linking it over the months, you know, with the programs we're funding to see how they fit and how we're actually making a difference in homelessness.
Well, and being able to connect all those missing pieces.
Yeah, we don't have time. We fund things and we see those outcomes, but we never take that.
Right.
Overall, we have X number of homeless, we have this many dollars, we have this many programs at the end of the year. Technically, we should have served.
Yeah.
We should have reduced homelessness by X, which I know is an impossible equation, but I think we could be more informed.
I agree.
So, that's just my thought.
So let's leave lots of time for that on the agenda.
Okay.
And then hopefully, is anyone going to join me tomorrow for the Navigation Center opening?
I will be there.
Yay.
I'll be working, so I don't know if I can slip in while I'm working.
Okay.
I'll try to get down.
I'll put you both in.
Oh, well, you're out then.
And Homeless Memorial is on the 21st of December.
Okay.
From 5:45 to 7 at St. Paul's Church.
December 21st?
Yes.
You send that out
in
an email or
something?
Yeah, well, it's going to be all over social media. We got the flyer done yesterday.
I don't do social media,
but if you send an email out, that'd be super cool.
Art of the year.
Do you, or Rebecca, do you have the flyer? Is it ready yet?
It's ready. Yeah.
When you have it ready, if you just email it to me, I will email it to the board.
Okay.
And
what I should do is just get an email list, and then I can put you guys all on my email list.
And you should have everybody's email on the roster list that was given out.
I will add.
And if Rebecca sends an email to all of us, then.
Gotcha. Okay. I will make a point to get you all on it.
Human Services Facility Council hearing November 19th.
That's the city. The city of Vancouver, and they're wanting to change that ordinance. So Peggy had mentioned at the last meeting that they're doing their actual hearing. So that's on the 19th at 7 p.m. at Council Chambers. She has also said you could watch it on CBTV if you aren't able to make it to the meeting.
I don't know. Next meeting is going to be the all day. Do we want to change that to 9 to 5 so we buy us some extra time? We've got 9 to 4, and then we could probably do a working lunch, couldn't we?
Let's do 4 on the work lunch.
Okay.
Either way, but I just want to not cut a short time.
Let me take a look at, because we're still formulating the trainings and things like that. So if we need to, people can stay, we can always
We just never have enough time.
We always do business in the morning. We get that we have to have. For the
meeting. Keep the business as short as
we can. I try.
Thank you, everybody.
Thanks, Hillary. I know that.